Fridays at 7 p.m. only on WRCT 88.3 FM. And right after that, on Saturdays, it's a fantastic Saturday night lineup, is Tembo Sounds, the culture. The Tembo Sounds Show is a uniquely curated radio show mixed and presented live by the scholar practitioner Dr. Oscar Radoli on WRCT Pittsburgh, Saturdays from 8 to 10 p.m. Well, that's all we have for you tonight. Thanks for tuning in, and don't touch that dial. Stay tuned for Vive Le Mach. The Machster will take you all the way until 1 in the morning. Thanks for listening to From the Basement. I'm DJ Addy, bidding you good night, and we'll see you next week.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hello, and welcome to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. Today we have Dr. Etta Fields Black, who's a professor of history here at CMU and who just won the Pulitzer for her book, Combi. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Could you take a moment to introduce yourself, what you do here, and what other stuff I may not have mentioned yet?
Sure. So I am a professor in the Department of History, and I teach courses on Africa and the African diaspora, which includes the Middle Passage, pre-colonial courses on pre-colonial African history, modern African history, the Middle Passage, of West African history through film. I also direct the Dietrich College Humanities Center.
So I asked you here to talk today because you did just win the Pulitzer Prize. Can you tell us a little about your book and about the Combahee River Raid?
Sure. So the book is about what happened on June 1st through 3rd, 1863. June 1st, about 9 p.m., Harriet Tubman and her group of spies, scouts, and pilots piloted Colonel James Montgomery, who was the commander of the raid, up the Combahee River in three armed U.S. gunboats. And aboard were the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers, about 300 black soldiers, and the 3rd Rhode Island Heavy Artillery, one battery of white soldiers. They burned 7 rice plantations in 6 hours, and all the buildings, the stables, the plantation owners' homes, the barns that had the previous year's rice crop in it. They opened the floodgates in the rice fields and destroyed the rice crop that was currently growing there. They burned a bridge at Combahee Ferry, which would prevent the Confederate planters from trading rice, exporting it, as well as using it to feed Confederate citizens and the Confederate military. And they freed 756 people. And I argue in Combahee that this was the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, largest and most successful, and second only to the Haitian Revolution in the history of the New World.
Wow. That's really cool. I also heard you found a family connection to that history.
I did. And a lot of people think that I assume that I wrote the book because my great-great-great-grandfather fought in the raid. And no.
No?
I actually learned this in the process of researching the book. I was looking for him and trying to find out more information about the Fields family at the time that I was starting the book. And so there are connections to the research, but I didn't set out to write a book about him and didn't really know the details. There's still more that we don't know, but I didn't know much besides his name and the name of his son. And father to son down to my great-grandfather. I didn't know much about him before I started writing the book.
That makes sense, because from my understanding, this is a pretty hidden history, which is why it's so awesome that you're bringing it to light.
Thank you so much.
So how did you do the research for this? Because I assume it's not as easy as, you know, going down and flipping open other books and learning all about it.
No, it's not. So I was really surprised that so little had been written about the raid and so little had been written about Harriet Tubman's Civil War service. And I think in large part that's because it's not her service, her leadership is not recorded in the official military record, which to me is not surprising. And what it meant is that I had to look in other places. So I started... And where I found much of the information about Tubman that, you know, historians didn't know before, came from the letters of abolitionists. Mm. Abolitionists who, with whom Tubman had been in community before the Civil War broke out, after she liberated herself, when she became part of abolitionist networks in Philadelphia, Massachusetts, and upstate New York. And so in the letters of some abolitionists who came down to Beaufort, Port Royal in the Sea Islands after a big battle in Beaufort called the Battle of Port Royal in November of 1861. I was able to find them writing letters home about Harriet Tubman and what she was doing. And it was often not the abolitionists themselves, but their children. Wow. So William Lloyd Garrison's son, for example, and Frederick Douglass's son, both of whom joined the military. Garrison was in the 55th Massachusetts. Douglass was in the 54th Massachusetts. Both of them were stationed in the area. They encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about her. So these were young people who grew up with Tubman, and they volunteered after this Battle of Port Royal to come down as the freedom seekers were adjusting to freedom. And they encountered Harriet Tubman and they wrote about them. For the freedom seekers, and I wanted very much to tell the story of the Cumbie River Raid through the people who were impacted by it, particularly the enslaved people who were liberated in it. And I found those sources at the National Archives, the U.S. Civil War pension files. So I'm using their testimony and the pension files to tell their side of the story.
Do the pension files have what they have to say about things as opposed to what the other people would have to say then?
They are very underused. And in the files, people testify about the raid. They also testify about their families. They testify about community life, courting and weddings and childbirth, going to church, and people who were not going to church and had gotten put out of the church for all kinds of modern behavior, like living with people with whom they were not married. So they talk about, you know, real life, and they talk about it in a way that historians had not seen. You don't see this in the historical literature of slavery, right? To hear people who were born and raised in bondage tell their own stories. And when I say raised, people who, you know, were not free until they were adults. So they spent much of their lives in bondage. We had not heard their stories. And so it is a very, the pension files, U.S. Civil War pension files, are definitely an underutilized resource.
So in terms of Combi, you were focusing on telling the story through the eyes of enslaved people. And I know you've also worked on other stuff like Requiem for Rice, which is like symphonic. So how does this working in interdisciplinary and multimedia works affect the way you kind of tell history?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have worked with both artists and scientists and worked with the scientists really to find interdisciplinary sources to tell the stories of people who didn't leave written documents. So in the case of peasant rice farmers in pre-colonial West Africa, right, using archaeology and soil science and biological and botanical studies of mangroves in order to find out how peasant rice farmers developed their mangrove rice technology. And then I work with artists to translate this research into broader audiences, really, and to translate it into artistic mediums, which will appeal to broader audiences, more people than would ever read my books, my previous books, at least.
yeah, I hope a lot of people are reading this one.
Combi's selling like hotcakes, but that's another story. to really bring this research to life, you know, and to find a way to communicate it so that people can really empathize with enslaved people and see them as humans and see them as, I say, mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers, you know, aunties, uncles, cousins, sweethearts, and baby mamas, to see them as just everyday people, you know, which I don't think is a way that we have been able to see enslaved people in the past.
Would you say that you work, even in your books, in terms of trying to bring it to a broader audience, or are they more of an academic thing and then you spread them out through your symphonic works or your librettes or stuff?
Yeah. So my previous two books were written for academic audiences. Combi is written for a general audience and published by a trade press. And so what I found is that working with the scientists and working with the artists, and sometimes I would be in the rice fields with both the scientists and the artists, and that was more fun than one should be allowed to have. that's transformed the way I write history, you know, and it's transformed the audience for which I want to write history. So it's no longer just an audience of academics, right? I want to write for academics and I want my work to be well, highly regarded by academics, but I also want to write for the general public. I want the general public to feel like they are a part of this history too.
Yeah, and it's a heavy history. Is there any way that you deal with going through all of that and writing about it? Because that seems intense.
Yeah, it was quite intense. There are a lot of emotions that come up in reading these documents, you know, primary source documents from the time, which are detailing what enslaved people endured. And my goal was always, first of all, to experience the emotions myself, and then to try to translate them, to try to channel them in a way that, to try to channel them into the writing, right, into the narrative, so that your average reader could experience what I experienced, what I felt, and could hopefully then empathize with enslaved people. Could think about them, as I said, as people, you know, whose families were being torn apart, whose health and bodies were constantly being put in jeopardy and exploited you know, to create a commercial rice industry, which was incredibly lucrative to the planters and the slaveholders, but which came at a great cost for the enslaved laborers.
I think you focus on the rice industry, which I think is interesting because when I think of, you know, what they were teaching me in high school about enslavement, they were mostly talking about cotton plantations. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little more about how rice played into that system?
Yeah. So rice is another little told story. We know that the foundations of the rice technology that was used to create the commercial rice industry in coastal South Carolina and Georgia came from West Africa. So it was brought here by enslaved people who were from the Rice Coast region, which is Senegal in the north, down to Liberia. We know that growing rice for commercial purposes with enslaved labor totally transformed this technology. And it created a very deadly environment for enslaved people because rice is grown in water, and standing water breeds mosquitoes, and those mosquitoes carried malaria, right? Malaria was endemic to the region. So people who were enslaved on these plantations, their health was completely compromised. They suffered from chronic malaria, which didn't kill them, but shattered their immune systems to the point where children were born, babies were born, and many failed to thrive and died before their first birthday. And 2/3 of children who survived the first year didn't survive past their 15th year. And then even as adults with, you know, years and years and years suffering from chronic malaria, couldn't fight off things like respiratory illness, right? So people are dying from other illnesses. They're not dying from malaria, but because of chronic malaria, their immune systems can't fight these other illnesses. Just a very deadly environment with the highest death rate, second highest in the New World, only to sugar plantations in the Caribbean. So it's something that a lot of Americans, we don't know about because cotton is sort of king in the U.S. South, but rice is also extremely, extremely important.
Are there any other untold stories that you like to focus on?
Well, I'm looking for the next one. I'm giving Cumbie its due. But I am also thinking about my next project and sort of laying the groundwork for the next project. So I want to continue telling untold stories. I want to continue giving voice to people who have heretofore been voiceless and exploring and finding new sources with which to tell their stories.
Yeah, that's really powerful. Do you have any ideas of what comes next, or is that still in the works?
Well, there is an art exhibit based on Cumbie that opens May 23rd. So there are no breaks here. Down in Charleston at the Gibbs Museum of Art, and it's called Picturing Freedom, Harriet Tubman in the Cumbie River Raid. I'm also in the very early stages of working with colleagues at CMU in information systems to create a portal through which we're going to crowdsource the transcriptions of a couple thousand U.S. Civil War pension files. And these files are this data set. Then we're going to use AI so that historians, genealogists, and family members can find out more information about individual enslaved people.
So in terms of AI, are there like new tools that you've been using lately that are coming out? Or are you still going through archives in an old library?
Well, both. I mean, I'm exploring AI with my colleagues so that I can just go through more. I transcribed with a team of research assistants transcribed about 200 pension files, more than 200 pension files for Cumbie. And now we're looking at thousands, right? And so I want to, and I want other people to really be able to access the pension files and to be able to access the information that's in them so that we can rewrite the histories of slavery and the Civil War.
In terms of working with your colleagues, I know you work in the Department of History, and you also are the director of the Humanities Center. How does that play into your work?
Well, I think that, you know, directing the Humanities Center, we are supporting faculty and graduate student research, original research, interdisciplinary collaborative research. And all of this is what I do, having collaborated with scientists, artists, and now, you know, the AI folks. And really supporting faculty in doing their amazing research, maybe doing more public-facing research if that's what they want to do. And just helping kind of break through the barriers that faculty run into in doing research in the humanities and making our work more visible. So in many ways, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do things like I have done, very ambitious projects, which in my case are very public facing. Yeah, I'm trying to empower more faculty to do more of that kind of work.
So in terms of your projects, you said Cumbie's selling like hotcakes, but is there anything that you worked on earlier in your career that you think people should pay a little more attention to?
Well, in my book Deep Roots, I'm using, I'm also telling untold stories and looking for new sources with which to tell them. So in that book, I'm using linguistic evidence and combining it with scientific evidence from particularly the botanical and biological studies of mangroves and different kinds of mangroves. I think it's a very interesting book. It's written for an academic audience, but it's all about endangered languages and recording endangered languages and using these endangered languages as a tool to tell the stories and reconstruct the history of people in coastal Guinea, West Africa, who also didn't leave written sources, and about whom many written sources by missionaries and slave traders and other kinds of traders were not really written. So really trying to fill that gap in the historical literature.
That's really cool. So in terms of the historical literature, it seems like a lot of it is written more by, as you said, missionaries or slave traders. Mm-hmm. Or like the stories that get written down are usually those of the people in power, maybe oppressing other people. How do you work with that when you're trying to tell your untold stories?
Well, some historians would disagree with me, but I don't throw those people in power out. What I do is I interrogate them as what I call hostile witnesses. And I try to, you know, fully acknowledging their biases, and try to find what is of historical value in their accounts. I also try to balance them. I don't rely on them completely, as historians have done in the past. So I try to balance them with other voices, particularly the voices of the people that I'm writing about, right? So in this case, the voices of enslaved people, I want to hear them tell their stories. And they often don't tell them in written form. In the case of the Cumbie River Raid, they're testifying orally for these pension applications. But sometimes their evidence is in the land, right? And so this is what I did with my first book, which is Deep Roots, is to try to understand how these peasant farmers who didn't leave written sources, how they changed the land, right? How they changed the landscape. We can use the fruits of their labor, if you will, as a historical source. We can use the rice fields they built as historical sources.
I think that's so interesting to use a rice field as a historical source.
I use a rice field for everything.
How did you first start studying rice?
Well, I was interested, and this goes back to my first year in college. I was interested in the Gullah Geechee, who are African Americans and descendants of slaves from coastal South Carolina and Georgia. And they live on the sea islands. They live in the mainland, meaning the cities and towns. But they also live on the rice plantations, which are right on the interior of the coast. I was very curious about this language and culture because my father was born about 2 miles, 1 or 2 miles from where the raid took place. He's the last of his siblings born in the South Carolina Lowcountry before my grandparents migrated their family to Florida. First, they went to the capital city, which is not the capital, but the city, which is Charleston. And then they went down to Miami, Florida, where I was born and where my dad grew up. So I was curious about the dialect that my grandparents spoke because it was different than anything else I heard anywhere else, except when we went to visit my great-grandmother in coastal South Carolina. So that sparked my curiosity. And I did a lot of reading about it as an undergraduate. And when I went to graduate school, was very interested in the Gullah Geechee and their West African connections. So how did West African languages and cultures influence what we call today the Gullah Geechee? And I chose rice as sort of the prism through which to look at that question. So that's how I got into studying rice, and I went to West Africa to begin my career, and then decided to write my second project on the other side of the Atlantic in the rice fields of coastal South Carolina and Georgia.
It's really cool that rice takes you all the way from West Africa to here to the Combahee River, right?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, we're starting to go a little low on time. Is there anything else you'd like to say?
I could say that, you know, Combahee is the first time that Harriet Tubman's Civil War service has been documented. And so that's a very important part now of her legacy and an important impact of the book. And Combahee also is introducing the U.S. Civil War pension files as a third source that historians can use to hear the voices and tell the stories of enslaved people in their own words and formerly enslaved people. And it's the U.S. Civil War pension files are also a source that genealogists and family members can use. Millions of African Americans can use to identify our enslaved ancestors and to learn our family history and to pass it down to future generations.
Thank you so much. This has been Dr. Etta Fields Black on Forbes Avenue.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to PA@WRCT.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready.
to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruising the Decades,
Brad Savage.
Brad Savage.
Thanks for tuning in to our wavelength. Welcome to Cruising the Decades, 100 years of music and cultural history in 1 hour. This is episode number 148, CruisingTheDecades.com. And this week we say hello and greetings to new listeners on our newest station, 88.7 WCSF in Joliet, Illinois, the college radio student station from the University of St. Francis. And on today's show, Cy Kernan of The Fix joins us, but it's a time warp to 1984, plus the mystery and wonder of Trout Mask Replica, one of the most remarkable albums of the late 1960s. And this world can't stand long. Roy Acuff warned us about it way back in 1948. Suggestive R&B in the early 1950s. And I know a junk food junkie. Do you? Well, let's get started with one song per decade, and we'll start over 100 years ago. Way back in 1917, I just came across this song recently. It's by singer Manuel Romaine, and it is called Honor Thy Mother and Father. This is Cruising the Decades. We're pulling out a wax cylinder recording from 1917. Let's start the show. CruisingTheDecades.com.
And good luck will follow you.
After amassing an absurd record library that takes up his entire basement, host Brad Savage decided to share over 100 years of music with the world. From super-powered shortwave broadcasters via internet streaming and on the top independent community and music radio stations across North America and the world, this is Cruisin' the Decades. 100 years of music.
Decades, 100 years of music. That was a 1926 recording by the Cavaliers called Sleepyhead. We'll send that one out to all the Wahoos listening in Charlottesville, Virginia. Wahoo Wah. Well, the Cavaliers were actually Ben Selvin and his band. Ben Selvin is a fascinating character in the history of recorded music. A band leader, musician, record producer. His nickname was the Dean of Recorded Music. And it is estimated that under all the different aliases that he recorded, he did somewhere between 13,000 and 20,000 different songs. How can that even be? Well, due to contractual obligations, he used many different names and aliases. The Cavaliers are one of them. But it was always him and different band members, and the man was obsessed with recording songs, many different sounds and styles. You could do a graduate level course just on the recordings of Ben Selvin. Once again, that was Sleepyhead on Cruise in the Decades, one song per decade and 100 years of music. Up next, it's Benny Goodman's orchestra, and this is Helen Ward on vocals, a 1936 recording of one of those standard songs, written in 1936 by Rodgers and Hart. It was originally for the musical called Billy Rose's Jumbo, and then it was later used in a different musical called On Your Toes. Very famous song. There's a Small Hotel from the Goodman Band on Cruisin' the Decades.
Technology and the evolution of musical styles of popular music through the decades and beyond. Over 100 years of music. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades, broadcast worldwide on AM, FM, and shortwave.
It's more wicked every day. The maker who created it will never let it stand this way. This world can't stand long. Be ready and don't be late. We should know this world can't stand, for it's too full of hate. Was so full of sin, and for that very reason
down, it's gotta be destroyed again. This world can't stand long, be ready and don't be late. We should know this world can't stand, for it's too full of hate. This world can't stand long, be ready and don't be late. We should know this world can't stand, for it's too full of hate. Burning sand. This world can't stand long, be ready and don't be late. We should know this world can't stand, for it's too full of hate.
Cruising the decades with the famous voice of Roy Acuff, one of his early hits in 1948. A song pleading for kindness and love. Roy Acuff is one of the most important figures in the history of country music and popular music, a country music Hall of Famer, and synonymous with the Grand Ole Opry for 40 years. What a great catalog of recordings he has if you listen in to his recorded music. That's what this show is all about. CruisingTheDecades.com. You can find all of our playlists and all of our shows on demand. And it's all about music appreciation. It's kind of the roots of modern music and where what we listen to today comes from. We do one song per decade. I'm Brad Savage, and we roll now into the R&B sounds of 1951. This is the best-known song by singer Connie Allen. I really enjoy listening to these sounds that directly laid the groundwork for what would become rock and roll just 5, 6, 7 years later. In this case, Connie Allen is backed by Todd Rhodes and his Toddlers, or the Todd Rhodes Orchestra. This is a fun one. It's called Rocket 69 on Cruising the Decades.
Rocket 69, Rocket 69.
We'll ride
we fly through the sky and go out of this world. I bet you, sweet papa, I can make you feel mighty fine. When you take a little trip on a Rocket 69.
Rocket 69, Rocket 69.
We'll zip it, we'll tip it
on the Rocket 69.
We'll rip it, we'll tip it
on the Rocket 69.
We'll flip it, we'll whip it
on the Rocket 69.
We'll ride and guide and be so satisfied. The trip will be fine in my Rocket 69.
Rocket 69, Rocket 69.
An audio journey, song by song, through every genre of popular music and recorded music history. From swing, jazz, folk, and blues, and the Great American Songbook, to punk, new wave, garage, and alternative. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage. 100 years of music, one song per decade.
Motown, 1963, the biggest solo hit for Eddie Holland. That was Leaving Here, a song which I discovered in the 90s when it was covered by Pearl Jam for a charity benefit album. And Holland, Dozier, Holland. You ever heard of that trio from Motown? Well, HDH refers to the songwriting and production team of Lamont Dozier and brothers Brian and Eddie Holland, who wrote some of the biggest songs for the entire Motown era. You're listening to Cruisin' the Decades. Chronologically, we do one song per decade for a time warp travel journey through music's glorious history. And we're going to hang out in the 1960s for one more bonus track. And this goes forward to 1969 for Captain Beefheart. Don Van Vliet is Captain Beefheart, and along with the Magic Band, wrote some of the most essential and absolutely strange recordings to ever be released commercially in the 60s and 70s. A real cult figure, a real record collector figure. We're going to zero in on Trout Mask Replica, released June of 1969, produced by Frank Zappa, a wildly experimental listen of R&B, garage rock, blues, and jazz, and just a really avant-garde composition. It's hard to listen to because it's so strange, but that is precisely what made it such a masterpiece and such an underground classic. In total, Trout Mask Replica has 28 songs and clocks in at nearly 79 minutes. And like I said, it's not the world's catchiest or most easy to listen to record, but its influence is unparalleled. Let's listen to this one called She's Too Much for My Mirror from Captain Beefheart off the classic Trout Mask Replica. Double album of 1969 on Cruisin' the Decades.
Here you would have a famous version of She's Too Much for My Mirror. Note the clever slate. She's Too Much for My or Anybody's Mirror, number two. Told you.
Soul. Oh, Chicago, she's a woman that make her young man a bum. She howl like the wind, make my heart grow cold. Make me long for that little red farm. She make things fly, she make things roll. She got me way over here and I'm hungry and cold. Told me I ought to be choosy. That was way back when. I thought you was my friend. Now I find out she's a floozy. I remember the butterflies and the sweet smell of corn in the bubbling fish in that little pond. Oh, losey. Oh, losey. How long for you? How long for you? She's too much for my mirror.
Show that parlays an obsessive lifelong collection of records and music history into a global broadcast of one song per decade. For over 100 years of popular recordings, you're hearing Cruisin' the Decades with Brad Savage on the best radio broadcast signals across North America and the world, AM, FM, and shortwave. This is Cruisin' the Decades.
You know I love that organic cooking, I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural, on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt, white sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes they are. All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth. Daytime I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. Well, at lunchtime you can always find me at the Whole Earth Vitamin Bar, just sucking on my plain white yogurt from a hand-thrown pottery jar. And sipping a little hand-pressed cider with a carrot stick for dessert. And wiping my face in a natural way on the sleeve of my peasant shirt. Oh, yeah. Ah, but when that clock strikes midnight and I'm all by myself, I work at combination on my secret hideaway shelf. And I pull out some Fritos corn chips, Dr. Pepper, and an old moon pie. Then I sit back in glorious expectation of a genuine junk food high. Oh, yeah, and it's Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. Oh, but at night I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. All right. My friends down at the commune, they think I'm pretty neat. Oh, I don't know nothing about arts and crafts, but I give them all something to eat. I'm a friend to old Yule Gibbons, and I only eat homegrown spice. I got a John Keats autographed Grecian urn filled up with my brown rice. Yes, I do. Oh, folks, but lately I have been spotted with a Big Mac on my breath. Stumbling into a Colonel Sanders with a face as white as death. I'm afraid someday they'll find me just stretched out on my bed, with a handful of Pringles, potato chips, and a ding-dong by my head. In the daytime, I'm Mr. Nasser, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
Fun little novelty number from Larry Gross from 1976. That is Junk Food Junkie. We'll send that one out to everyone listening in Charleston, West Virginia on the Status Quo WTSQ 88.1 FM. You see, Larry Gross hails from West Virginia and spent a number of years as the artistic director and host of Mountain Stage, the great national live music radio show that originates there in Charleston. But that song is just kind of a fun surprise that reached number 9 on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100. Larry Gross, Cruising the Decades. I'm Brad Savage. This show is heard worldwide on the greatest independent and community and music appreciating radio stations all around the world. Shortwave on WBCQ, The Planet, and